Shall we bow our heads for prayer? Father in heaven, we thank you so much for the privilege of being here today. The world is in turmoil. Nations are angry. And we want to know exactly what's happening and what will soon transpire in this world. We want to be ready for the coming of Jesus. And so we ask that as we study about the role of the United States in Bible prophecy, that your Holy Spirit will be with us to instruct us. Give us tender hearts to receive the message that you have for us. And we pray these things in the precious name of Jesus, your beloved Son. Amen. We would like to begin our study today reviewing three prophecies that we have already gone over in this seminar. The first of these prophecies is found in Revelation chapter 12. And basically, I'm just going to review. We're not going to look up the verses because we've studied this before. Revelation 12 begins in the Old Testament with this woman who is with child. That indicates that this is the Old Testament period because the child has not been born yet. And then, of course, you have this dragon. And this dragon wants to devour the child as soon as the child is born. It becomes very clear that this power is Rome, because Rome is the power which tried to slay Jesus when Jesus was born. Now, this dragon had 10 horns. And the 10 horns represent the 10 divisions into which the Roman Empire was divided. Then, as you continue this process in Revelation chapter 12, you have the woman fleeing into the wilderness for 1,260 days, or time, times, and the dividing of time. And then you find, at the end of that period, that the earth helps the woman and swallows up the waters of persecution which the dragon spewed out of his mouth. And then finally, in verse 17, you have the dragon angry with the woman. And he goes to make war with the remnant of her seed who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So we've moved from the Old Testament, before the child is born, to Rome, when the child is born, to the 10 divisions into which the Roman Empire was divided, to the 1260 years, to a time when the earth helped the woman, eventually to the final war when the dragon is enraged with the woman and goes to make war with the remnant of her seed who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So Revelation 12 begins in the Old Testament and it continues till the final war of Satan against God's people. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, we have a very similar sequence. Daniel chapter 7 presents a lion, which is Babylon, a bear, which is Medo-Persia, a leopard, which is Greece, and then the fourth beast is a dragon-like beast, which is Rome. You see, that dragon-like beast is the same dragon that stood next to the woman to devour her child in Revelation 12. And we're told there in Daniel chapter 7 that this dragon beast sprouted 10 horns. There you have the same dragon with 10 horns as in Revelation 12. And then we're told that among the 10 rises a little horn. And the little horn rules for time, times, and the dividing of time. 1260 years, the same period that the woman fled to the wilderness where the dragon tried to slay her. And then we notice in Daniel chapter 7 that this little horn is destroyed when Jesus comes. He's judged and destroyed when Jesus comes, which means that this little horn must last until Jesus comes. You say, now wait a minute, you just said that this horn was going to have dominion for time, times, the dividing of time, 1260 years. And now you're saying that he's going to exist until the second coming of Jesus. It must be that this horn is going to rule for 1260 years, then it is going to lose its rulership, and its rulership is going to be restored in order for this power to be destroyed when Jesus comes. Because if he's going to be around when Jesus comes and he's going to be destroyed, he must be ruling when Jesus comes. So we notice that Daniel chapter 7 follows the same sequence of Revelation 12. Begins in the Old Testament with Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. Continues with the fourth beast, Rome, the dragon-like beast. The dragon-like beast sprouts 10 horns, just like the dragon-like beast in Revelation 12. Then, as in Revelation 12, the woman flees to the wilderness for 1,260 years. The little horn rules for 1,260 years. And then in Revelation chapter 12, verse 16, you have the earth helping the woman. In other words, the period of persecution for the woman comes to an end. And then, of course, you have the final onslaught against God's people, which the dragon is enraged with the woman and goes to make war with the remnant of her seed. Daniel chapter 7 does not directly present that, but it does tell us that the horn is going to be destroyed when Jesus comes, which gives us the idea that the little horn is going to resurrect to power again. Now, Revelation 13 follows the same basic sequence as Revelation 12 and Daniel 7. In Revelation 13, verse 2, you have a dragon, which is the fourth beast, and then you find three beasts that are mentioned that come before the dragon. You have a leopard, you have a bear, and you have a lion. So notice that Revelation 13 follows the same order of Daniel 7. You have a lion, a bear, a leopard, a dragon. And that dragon has 10 horns, as we've noticed. And then the dragon with the 10 horns gives his throne, his seat, and his authority to the beast. And then the beast rules 42 months. Isn't this interesting? The same sequence. The beast governs 42 months. And at the end of the 42 months, the beast's power is removed. But we're told in Revelation 13, which by the way is amplifying Daniel chapter 7, that this beast which received a deadly wound, its deadly wound is going to be what? Its deadly wound is going to be healed, and everyone is going to marvel after the beast. The whole world is going to marvel after the beast. So you'll notice once again the same sequence of events. Revelation 13 begins with Babylon, then Medo-Persia, then Greece, then Rome, the dragon beast. The dragon beast has 10 horns, and that dragon beast gives his power to the beast, who rules 1,260 years. It's expressed as 42 months. And then, at the end of this period, this power receives a deadly wound. For a while, it's inactive, but then its deadly wound is healed, and you have the final persecution against God's people. So Revelation 12, Daniel 7, and Revelation 13 are parallel prophecies. Is this clear in your mind? Now, what I particularly want us to notice is that this fourth beast has three stages of existence. Notice Daniel chapter 7, verses 23 and 24. Daniel chapter 7 and verses 23 and 24. We're told here the following. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. And now notice verse 24. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom. Do you see the sequence? You have the dragon beast. Then 10 horns rise from this kingdom. And then it says in the last part of the verse, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. So how many stages does this fourth beast have? It has four. Actually, three stages. We're going to notice that there's a fourth when it resurrects. But it has three for our purposes right now. The first stage is the dragon beast ruling by itself. The second stage is the period of this dragon with 10 horns. And the third stage is the dragon beast with the little horn on its head. Now, you notice that all of the beasts in Daniel chapter 7 come up from the waters. Now, what do waters represent in Scripture? Well, let's go to Isaiah chapter 17 and verses 12 and 13. Isaiah 17 and verses 12 and 13. All of these beasts come up from waters. It says there in verse 12 of Isaiah 17, "Woe to the multitude of many people who make a noise like the roar of the seas, and to the rushing of nations, like the rushing of mighty waters." So you notice that waters represent what? Nations, and represent multitudes of peoples. All of the beasts of Daniel 7 rise from waters. So let me ask you, do they rise in the same geographical location? Absolutely. Because they all rise from the waters, where there are multitudes of peoples. Now what I would like us to do is go to the end of the first stage of power of the little horn or the beast. Go with me to Revelation chapter 13 and verses 9 and 10. Revelation chapter 13 and verses 9 and 10. This is after the little horn or the beast has ruled for 1260 years, or time times the dividing of time, 42 months. It's the same period expressed in different terms. Notice Revelation chapter 13 and verse 9. "If anyone has an ear, let him hear. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity." Who was it that led into captivity during the 1260 years? The beast or the little horn. "He who leads into captivity," it says here, "shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints." What was this power going to receive at the end of the 1260 years of dominion, at the end of the 42 months or the time times and dividing of time? He was going to receive a death wound. What was going to give him the death wound? A what? A sword. Now immediately you ask the question, what does a sword represent in Bible prophecy? Now I know that the sword represents the Bible, because the Bible is the sword of the Spirit. But in this case, the sword does not represent the Bible. The sword represents the civil powers of the world that this beast power, or this little horn power, used to accomplish its purposes. You say, how do we know that? Well, go with me to the book of Romans, chapter 13. Romans, chapter 13. Here the Apostle Paul is speaking about being subject to the civil powers. And he says this, Romans 13 and verse 1. "Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God." Now let's jump down to verse 4. "For he," that is the civil power or the magistrates, "he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. For he does not bear the what? The sword in vain. For he is God's minister, an avenger, to execute wrath on him who practices evil." Question. What does the sword represent in Romans 13? It represents the magistrates. It represents the civil power which preserves the civil order. So if Revelation 13 verse 10 says that this beast was going to be wounded by the sword, it must mean that this beast was going to be wounded by the power of what? It was going to be wounded by the power of the state, or by the civil power. Now let me ask you, we've already identified this system as the Roman Catholic papacy. Did the Roman Catholic papacy employ the civil powers of Europe to fulfill its purposes during the 1260 years? All you have to do is read history books. They allied themselves with the state and used the state to accomplish its purpose, the papacy's purpose. So what must it mean that suddenly the sword now rises against this power? It must mean that the civil power now rises against the papal power. It's no coincidence, folks, that in the year 1798, February 10 of 1798, General Berthier entered the Vatican City. The Pope was celebrating the anniversary of his accession to the throne. It was Pius VI, by the way. And Berthier came in. He removed the Pope from his throne. The Pope was taken captive, and he spent some time in different locations, and he finally died in exile in France. It's interesting that Napoleon Bonaparte had the express intention of abolishing the papacy. In other words, France removed from the papacy the ability to use the civil power. And do you know what's interesting? No country in Europe wanted to have anything to do with the Roman Catholic papacy immediately after 1798. They did not want to touch this system with a 10-foot pole because they knew what had happened during the 1260 years of the dominion of this power. And so France rose against this power and removed its civil authority. In other words, the Roman Catholic Church did not disappear as a church, but it could no longer use the civil powers of the world to accomplish its purposes. Malachi Martin, in his book, The Keys of This Blood, has a statement where he says that the civil powers of the world have imposed 200 years of inactivity upon the Roman Catholic papacy. He himself recognizes that the papacy can no longer use the civil powers of the world to accomplish the purposes that it accomplished during the 1260 years. And so basically what we have in all three of these prophecies, Revelation 12, Daniel 7, and Revelation 13, it begins in the Old Testament, moves to the period of the dragon, then it moves to the period of the dragon with 10 horns, then it moves to the period of the 1260 years of persecution, and then Revelation 13 emphasizes that at the end of this period of persecution, persecution ceases. Revelation 12 emphasizes that the earth helps the woman and swallows up the waters of persecution. But then the devil is angry. And so he rises this power to new life. The deadly wound is healed. And you have the final onslaught against those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Now in Revelation 13, we have a second beast which rises. And we need to identify this second beast. And I have 12 characteristics that I want to share with you in identifying this second beast. Let's go to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 11. And we're going to stay in that verse for several characteristics. I'm going to take one by one. Revelation 13 and verse 11 says, then. What does that indicate, then? It indicates that this is transpiring when? After the first beast received its deadly wound. Because the previous verse speaks about the deadly wound. And what date was the deadly wound given? 1798. That's a matter of history. You can read it in any history book. Which means that this beast is going to arise after which date? Or at which date? It's going to arise around the year 1798. After the first beast receives its wound. Secondly, you'll notice that it says in verse 11 that he saw another beast. Now, what does a beast represent in prophecy? A beast represents a kingdom or a nation. The lion is Babylon. The bear is Medo-Persia. The leopard is Greece. The dragon is Rome. Whenever you find beasts in prophecy, it represents nations or kingdoms. So my question is this going to be a nation or a kingdom which will arise around the year 1798? Absolutely. Now let's notice our third characteristic. Once again, Revelation 13 and verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. We need to take a look at that expression, coming up. It's the expression that is used to describe the sprouting of a plant. In other words, you're not talking about a full-grown tree. You're talking about the sprouting of a plant. That is that when this power was rising, it had not reached the apex of its power. It actually was just beginning to germinate or to sprout when John saw it rise. Incidentally, in Matthew 13 and verse 7, This expression, coming up out of, is used in the parable of the sower to speak about a plant growing up out of the earth. So our third characteristic is that in 1798, this power was not fully grown. It was just sprouting out of the earth at that time. Now let's notice the fourth characteristic. It says there in verse 11, then I saw another beast coming up out of the what? Coming up out of the earth. It comes out of the earth. That is significant. You say, why is it significant? Well, let me ask you, where did all of the previous beasts come up from? We've already noticed it. They came up from waters where there were multitudes and nations and tongues and peoples. Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, all arose from waters. But suddenly we see this beast that rises out of what? That rises up out of the earth. Would this seem to indicate that this power is going to rise in a different place? Obviously. That's the strong impression that you get. Furthermore, there are not only any waters, there are also no winds. In other words, this power is not rising due to warfare. Furthermore, this power does not fight any of the previous powers to gain its ascendancy. Let me ask you, did the bear fight the lion to get its power? Sure. Did the leopard fight the bear to get its power? Yes. Did the dragon fight the leopard to gain its power? Absolutely. Each successive kingdom conquers the previous kingdom. But with this beast of Revelation 13, it comes up out of the earth. There are no waters, which means that there must be a very scarcity of inhabitants. It's a different place. There are no winds, which we've already studied, represents war, represents warfare. This must be a power that rises in a different place, not in the midst of conquest, not conquering previous nations. So this power rises in a different place. Let's go to our fifth characteristic. This one is not directly found in Revelation 13, but I think that we need to mention it because it's important. If you notice the beasts of Daniel chapter 7, you'll find that the first two beasts rise in Asia, Babylon and Medo-Persia. The next two beasts rise in Europe. In other words, prophecy is moving from east to west. Now, this beast that you find here rises from the earth after all of these powers have risen. Would you expect this power to rise further west than Asia or Europe? Sure. Because prophecy is moving in what direction? Prophecy is moving from east to west. By the way, the reason why this happens is because God's people are moving from east to west. Prophecy moves with God's people. When God's people move, when Christianity moves west, prophecy moves west. Because prophecy fulfills with God's people. And so this power is further west than Asia or Europe. Characteristic number six. This power is a global power. In fact, it not only is a global power, but the power that existed before is also a global power. Let me ask you, the little horn or the beast that governed for 1260 years, was this a global power? It most certainly was. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 7 says that it ruled over every nation, over every kindred, over every tongue, and over every people during the 1260 years. Now that's interesting. So you have one global power, and then you're going to notice that this beast of Revelation 13 is also a global power. So you have two global powers. You have the one that ruled during the 1260 years, and you have this power, or this kingdom, which arises in 1798. And you know what's very, very interesting? Is the fact that this second power, this second global power, which comes up out of the earth, instead of fighting with the previous power, it helps the previous power regain its authority. If you look at this second beast, its only purpose is an intention is to restore power to the previous beast. Very different than all of the other beasts. All of the other beasts tried to annihilate the previous power. But this power actually helps the previous power regain its ascendancy, its political and religious ascendancy. So you're supposed to look for two global powers. One which ruled in the past, and one which rises around the year 1798, which will help the previous power recover its throne. Now, characteristic number 7 will go a step further. Not only are these global powers, but this second power must also be a global political power. You say, why is it a global political power? Go with me to Revelation chapter 13 and verse 16. Revelation 13 and verse 16. It says there about this second beast, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. Must this power have political clout in order to make everyone receive the mark of the beast? It most certainly have worldwide political influence. So it must be a worldwide global political power. But it is also a global economic power. You say, how do we know that? Notice Revelation 13 and verse 17. It says in verse 17, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Does this power control commerce? Does it control business? Yes, it does, because it controls buying and selling. It must be a global economic power. But this power must also be a global military power. It must have the power to enforce its decrees. Notice Revelation chapter 13 and verse 15. Revelation 13 and verse 15. It says, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be what? To be killed. So does it have worldwide military power to enforce the decrees of that first beast? Absolutely. Now, what have we seen so far? Reviewing. Number one, this power must arise around the year 1798. Number two, it is a nation or a kingdom because it's a beast. Number three, it's just sprouting up around the year 1798. Number four, it rises out of the earth where there are very few inhabitants. It does not arise by fighting any of the previous powers. There's no winds of strife. In other words, it's going to help the previous power recover its power. Number five, it is going to arise further west than Asia and Europe. Number six, it is going to be a global power along with that first power that ruled 1260 days. Number seven, it is going to exercise worldwide political power. Number eight, it is going to exercise worldwide economic power. Number nine, it is going to exercise global or worldwide military power. Now let's go to number 10. It is going to be contemporaneous with the first beast. What do I mean by contemporaneous? In other words, they're going to be contemporaries. In other words, this second beast does not really succeed the first beast, but they actually rule together. Are you following me or not? They exist at the same time. And the purpose of the second beast is to give power back to the first beast. But they're contemporaries. So what you have to do is you have to look for two powers around the year 1798 and afterwards who are both global powers and who rule at the same period of time in history. Now, characteristic number 11. We're told that this second beast makes an image to the first beast. But let me ask you, what is an image? An image is a replica, a copy, a reproduction. So if this beast is going to make an image to the first beast, is this image going to be similar to what the first beast did? Sure. So what do you have to do? You have to go and look at the characteristics of the first beast. Question. Did the first beast attempt to change God's law? Sure. So if this beast makes an image to the first beast, is there going to be something having to do with a change in God's law? Obviously, yes. Did the first beast change God's prophetic line of events? In other words, did he attempt to change God's prophetic calendar? Yes, he did. He instituted preterism, the idea that prophecy was fulfilled in the distant past, and he implemented futurism, the idea that the Antichrist is going to arise in the future, way at the end of time. In that way, people could see that the Antichrist was right in front of them, because they were looking way to the past or they were looking way to the future. Must this second beast then have the same counterfeit prophetic interpretation system? Absolutely. Now, that beast, during the 1260 years, mixed or blended church and state. If this beast is going to make an image, must this also be a blending of church and state? Absolutely. This first beast persecuted those who were not in harmony with the union of church and state, who did not agree with the changes that were made. Are we to expect that this second beast is going to bring also persecution for the same motivations? Absolutely. No doubt about it. Now let's go to characteristic number 12. This is the last one. Revelation 13 and verse 11. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 11. Here we find another characteristic which we haven't read before, and so we're going to read it now. It says, "Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and spoke like a what? Spoke like a dragon." He had two horns like what? Two horns like a lamb. Now, what does that mean, two horns like a lamb? Well, let's first of all determine what horns mean in Bible prophecy. Do you know what horns mean in Bible prophecy? Horns represent kingdoms or divisions of kingdoms. For example, in Daniel chapter 8, you have a ram with two horns. The two horns represent the kingdoms of Media and Persia. You have four horns that come out of the head of the he-goat of Daniel 8, represents the four divisions of the Grecian Empire after the death of Alexander the Great. And so horns represent kingdoms. And you're saying, what in the world could be represented by these two horns? Is that talking about the idea that this is going to be two nations or two kingdoms? We already read that there's only one beast, but this beast has two horns. Is it possible that this kingdom is going to be a dual kingdom in some sense of the word? The answer is yes. Now, before I pursue the meaning of the two horns, allow me to go through the characteristics once again and ask which nation fulfills these exact details. What nation arose around the year 1798, is a nation, bona fide nation, was just sprouting in 1798, arose where there were very few inhabitants, did not fight any of the previous powers of prophecy, is further west than Europe and Asia, is a global power contemporary with the first power, has worldwide political clout, worldwide economic clout, worldwide military might, which actually is now helping that first beast get its power back, and which is reflecting many of the same teachings and practices of that first power. Listen, folks, there's no doubt whatsoever what this beast represents. It represents the United States of America. You say, how is that? Did the United States arise to power around the year 1798? Absolutely. In fact, the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776. The Constitution in 1787. 1791, you have the Bill of Rights. In 1798, you have the deadly wound. Incidentally, do you know which was the first nation that the United States formed official diplomatic relations with? It was France. Do you know what year? 1798. The first nation to recognize the United States as a bona fide nation was the very nation that gave the deadly wound to that first beast. That's significant. Is the United States a nation or a kingdom? It most certainly is. Was the United States fully grown when it first arose to power? Or was it just sprouting up in 1798? It was just sprouting up. Did the United States arise in a sparsely populated area? Yes. Did it have to defeat any of the kingdoms of Europe, of Bible prophecy, that had existed before? Absolutely not. Is the United States further west than Europe and Asia? It most certainly is. Is the United States ruling contemporaneously with that first beast? Are they both worldwide systems? The Roman Catholic Papacy and the United States? Absolutely. Is the United States a political global power? It is. Is the United States a global economic power? It most certainly is. Is the United States a global military power? Absolutely. Is the United States contemporaneous with the first beast? And actually, by what we're seeing today, is it helping that first beast recover its power and its authority? Absolutely. And I will share with you a little bit more about that later on. Is Protestantism in the United States today, in this country, talking about joining church and state and actually joining church and state? Absolutely. What day of worship do they say we're supposed to keep? The first day of the week. Do they say that prophecy is fulfilled with the papacy and with apostate Protestantism? Is that their perspective of prophecy? No. Where are they looking? They're looking back at a fellow called Antiochus Epiphanes, or they're looking forwards to some future Antichrist after the church has been raptured to heaven. The only thing that is missing of making an image to the first beast is the persecution aspect, because these things have not yet fully matured. Are you with me or not? Now let's talk about the two horns. The two horns like a lamb. The word lamb is used in Revelation 29 times. Every single time, the lamb is a symbol of Jesus Christ, with this one exception. Now, if the lamb is a symbol of Christ, must these two horns have something to do with Christ? Absolutely. Now, we notice that horns represent kingdoms. You say, well, the United States isn't two kingdoms. The United States is one kingdom. You're right. But allow me to tell you in what sense you have two kingdoms in this country. Let me ask you, did Jesus teach that there are two kingdoms? He said, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. Did Jesus recognize there are two kingdoms? Did he teach that they're supposed to remain separate? He sure did. By the way, the two horns are not one horn, they're two horns. They're separate. They're on the same beast, but they're separate. Are you following me or not? Did Jesus say that my kingdom is not of this world? He most certainly did. In that way, he's recognizing that there's another kingdom that is his. It's not from this world. Now, my question is this. When the United States began as a nation, did it recognize that there are actually two kingdoms or two powers? It most certainly did. Did it teach that those two kingdoms need to remain separate one from another? Absolutely. What kingdoms are we talking about? We're talking about church, which is Christ's kingdom spiritually on earth, and what? State. Church and state. Two kingdoms. But that are supposed to be what? Separate from one another. Now, allow me to read you the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. It's interesting how this, you know, I was listening to a senator, a very prominent senator, the other day on television, on Meet the Press, and I had to write a letter to Tim Russert to tell him, how did you let him get away with that? But let me tell you what the issue was. This is what the First Amendment says. By the way, the First Amendment actually has an Establishment Clause, a Free Exercise Clause, and a Civil Liberties Clause. In the same amendment, you have religious and civil liberty. It says there, the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That's been reinterpreted to mean that Congress cannot establish a church or a religion above other religions. That's not what the First Amendment says. And that's what this senator says. He says what the First Amendment forbids is from the Congress making a law establishing a religion. It doesn't say a religion. It says religion. Period. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. In other words, Congress can make no laws having to do with religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, Congress cannot make laws implementing religion or forbidding the free exercise of religion. But then the First Amendment continues saying this, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, you have these two principles. Religious liberty, God's kingdom ruling itself without interference of government, and the civil power functioning without the interference of the church. In other words, each of these kingdoms separate, following the principle that Christ established, that you have two kingdoms, but the kingdom of God is supposed to be separate from the kingdom of men or from the civil power. Incidentally, these two principles are called republicanism and Protestantism. Republicanism simply means a state without a king. And Protestantism means a church without a pope. Because in the Middle Ages, you know, if the king said jump, you said how high? I mean, the king had all power. The people had no power. The king spoke and people obeyed. It was a monarchy. The same was in the church. You know, when the pope spoke, everybody did what he said in the religious realm. There was no civil or religious liberty. But the founding fathers of the United States decided that they would establish a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Where religion would be protected by the state in the sense that people could practice their religion, the government would not interfere, and people could be free to worship God according to the dictates of their conscience. Republicanism and Protestantism. In other words, the separation of the two kingdoms. Now, why would our founding fathers do this? Why would they want this kind of government? Well, you see, they had the benefit of three things. Number one, they had the benefit of knowing what had happened during the Middle Ages when church and state are joined together. They lived very close to that period. I mean, 1798, that's when the deadly wound was given. They were close to the history. One of the problems in the United States is that people don't remember history anymore. They don't remember what this power has done in the past. And so they're allowing this power to gain ascendancy again, which is scary. But anyway, you know, we find that the founders had the benefit of knowing the history of the Middle Ages, what happens when church and state are joined together. They knew it leads to persecution, like John Huss, who was burned at the stake because he didn't agree with the teachings of the church. So they say, in this republic, we're not going to have that problem. Church and state are going to be separate one from another. They also knew the history of the colonial period of the United States. That's a period which many people forget. Do you know that the pilgrims came here looking for freedom? By the way, the earth helped the woman. That's what Revelation 12 means when it says the earth helped the woman. They fled from Europe. They came over here. They came to the territory of the United States to look for freedom. And once they established themselves, they took away people's freedom in the colonial period. If you did not return your tithes, by the way, the government paid the pastors. People, you know, they returned their tithes or they paid their tithes like a tax. And then the government paid the ministers. And if you didn't pay your tithe, you could be thrown in jail. If you did not go to church on Sunday, which they believed to be the day of worship, you could be thrown in jail or you could be flogged. Only people who professed the Christian religion could occupy offices in the government, positions in the government. In the colonial period, in the early history of the United States, not the constitutional period. And Roger Williams, who came in the year 1629 from England to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, he suffered the wrath of the people there because he was teaching the total separation of church and state. He had to flee in the dead of winter, a very raw winter. He had to cross huge snow drifts. And finally, he ended up in Rhode Island, and he established the capital of Rhode Island, known as Providence. And it became a city of refuge for everyone, Quakers, Jews, atheists. All he said, I want you to come here. You can worship God any way that you wish. As long as you work hard and you obey the civil laws, you'll be welcome here. But he was persecuted. They wanted to lynch him because of his ideas of separation of church and state. He was certainly a man ahead of his time. Now, I want you to notice that as we look at what's happening at the United States, or with the United States, It's so amazing, and it's happening so fast that it makes you dizzy. You know, I wish I had a lot of time here to talk to you about all of the track record of what's happened since 1963. It actually all began at Vatican II, where under the name Aggiornamento, renewal of the Catholic Church, they gave the Catholic Church a facelift. No longer Mass in Latin. You know, they could sing in the worship services and so on. It was all cosmetic changes to make the Church attractive to Protestants. And then, of course, you have the election of John F. Kennedy. I'm not saying that he was used by the Catholic Church, but basically there were people who were scared of having a Catholic as a president. But when John Kennedy came in and he seemed to do a pretty good job, people liked him pretty well, they said, hey, it's not just such a threat to have a Roman Catholic as a president of the United States. And then, of course, we could go to the 80s, the Holy Alliance. So it was called by Time magazine. It was on the cover with Reagan and the Pope on the cover of Time. The Holy Alliance, where the United States helped the Pope overthrow communism in the former Soviet Union. It was actually a secret alliance between the United States and the Vatican to overthrow communism. And then, of course, you have the book, The Keys of This Blood. Interesting book written by a Roman Catholic Jesuit, Malachi Martin. In that book, he says that there are three powers in this world vying to sit on the throne of the world. Number one, communism. Number two, Western capitalism. And number three, the Roman Catholic papacy. And in that book, he guarantees, and by the way, this is before it happened, he guarantees that communism was going to fall, Western capitalism was going to fall, and eventually, the Roman Catholic papacy was going to regain the throne of the world. You know, we've just seen the death of the Pope. I can't help but be amazed as I watch at television, every single news program on television. You can't get any other kind of news. And you have Protestant ministers, and you have Jewish rabbis, and you have people who don't claim the Christian religion being interviewed by these programs, and they're saying how wonderful this system is, how wonderful this man is. The whole world, according to Revelation 13, would wonder after the beast. And by the way, in order for this prophecy to be fulfilled, that the United States is going to help this first power regain its ascendancy, three walls have to come down. First wall is the wall of communism, represented by the Berlin Wall. That thing came down. The second wall that needs to be knocked down is the wall between Protestants and Catholics. And that is coming down. The document, Evangelicals and Catholics Together, which is a group of very influential evangelicals and very influential Roman Catholics, signed a document saying that they basically agree on doctrine and they should just forget their differences and they're supposed to go out and evangelize the world. The Joint Declaration on Righteousness by Faith by Catholics and Lutherans, where basically they're saying that the Protestant Reformation was a mistake. They're saying that Catholics and Protestants agree on the issue of justification by faith. This has just happened in the last few years. Recently in Time magazine, there was an incredible article where it says that Protestants are adopting the Roman Catholic view of Mary. Now, if this isn't telling us that we're close to the end, I don't know what does. Furthermore, there was a Time magazine article which described the red state, so-called, from the South, and how Protestants and Catholics are allying themselves together to take over the political system. This is only in the last two or three months that I'm talking about. So certainly the wall of separation between Protestants and Catholics is coming down. Do I need to say anything about the third wall, the wall of separation between church and state? I mean, it is coming down so fast, there are so many bricks that have been knocked off of that wall that there's not much wall left. You know, Protestants allying themselves with Catholics to take over the government. And in the Mary Schiavo case, you can see this. You know, they're actually trying to use Congress to intervene in this case, which is a problem of separation of powers, incidentally. Not only that, Thank God that the judiciary is still an independent judiciary. Thank God that the judges are elected for life. And they don't have to worry about elections. Because what is going to happen someday when the multitudes will not only be able to influence Congress, for Congress to do what they want, even intervene in the case of one person, which, by the way, I don't believe the feeding tube should have been removed. I'll tell you that. I believe that it should have been left in. But apart from that point, it's the mechanism or the process that was used that's a problem. You know, influencing the religious right, influencing Congress to intervene in this case. What's going to happen when the judges feel the heat and feel the pressure? Then God's people are not going to have any court of appeal. And that's happening right before our eyes. Are you understanding what I'm saying? Now, in closing, I'd like to say that there are two stories from the book of Daniel that illustrate the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. You see, our founding fathers not only knew, and by founding fathers I mean the constitutional fathers, they not only knew the history of the Middle Ages, when church and state are joined together. They not only knew the history of the colonial period of the United States. Therefore, they said, we're not going back to the colonial period. And that's why you have the Constitution, and that's why you have the Bill of Rights. The amendments to the Constitution. They said, we're not going down that road of the Middle Ages or the colonial period. They also knew their Bibles. Believe it or not. They knew the stories of Daniel 3 and Daniel 6. And this is what I'm going to speak about to end our study today. Daniel 3, Nebuchadnezzar tried to establish religion. Have you ever noticed that? He raised an image, and he says, everybody's going to worship that image. By the way, this is symbolic of what's going to happen at the end of time. Nebuchadnezzar, who lived for a beast for a period of time, lived as a beast, raised an image. Whoever did not worship the image was to be killed. Does that sound like Revelation 13? You have an image to the beast. Whoever doesn't worship will be what? Killed. Only back there, it was local over there in Babylon. At the end of time, it's going to be a global situation. And the image is not going to be a literal image. It is a symbolic image, as we've studied. It's, in other words, it's a reflection of what that first beast was like during the Middle Ages. But anyway, Nebuchadnezzar tries to establish religion. He says, everybody has to worship this way. The government says so. But three young men said, you can't establish religion. It's beyond your authority. And the king says, okay, I'll burn you in the fire. They say, God will deliver us. And if he doesn't, we'll still not serve. We'll still not follow your establishment of religion. And you know what happened? They were thrown into the furnace, but Jesus himself came into the furnace and delivered them. Is that going to happen at the end of time again? Is there going to be an establishment of religion, even though we have the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States? Absolutely. And then you have the story of Daniel chapter 6. You know, it's similar but different. Because in Daniel chapter 6, what the king is doing, he's forbidding the free exercise of religion. I don't know whether you've noticed the difference. In Daniel 3, Nebuchadnezzar is saying you have to worship this way. In Daniel chapter 6, the king is saying you can't worship the way you want to worship. In other words, the second king is forbidding the free exercise of religion. He says you can't pray to anyone except to the king for a period of 30 days. And Daniel says, well, this is the realm of God. This is not the realm of government. So he says, I feel the perfect freedom to practice the free exercise of religion. And so Daniel goes to his room and he kneels and he prays as usual. He's practicing the freedom of religion. And what happens as a result? The Bible says that he was thrown into the den of lions. And interestingly enough, it was the angel of the Lord, Christ in the Old Testament, incidentally, who came into the lion's den and closed the mouths of the lions. Do you know that even Nebuchadnezzar and Darius did not really understand the principle even after these stories happened? Do you know what Nebuchadnezzar said immediately after God delivered the three young men from the furnace? He says, "Now I give a decree that whoever doesn't worship the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be cut in pieces." He was out of bounds. Because you can't enforce the worship of a false god or a true god. Worship belongs to God and only to God, not to government. And Darius did the same thing. He says, "Now I give a decree that everyone is to tremble at the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." He was out of bounds. That is not the realm of the government. Are you understanding what I'm saying? And so Revelation chapter 13, this second beast represents the United States. One final point. In Revelation chapter 12, it says that the earth helped the woman. That earth there is the territory. Revelation 13, you have a beast that rises from the earth. That's the nation that rises in the territory that is mentioned in Revelation chapter 12. And in Revelation chapter 12, it says that after the earth helps the woman, the dragon is enraged with the woman. In Revelation chapter 13, interestingly enough, it says that after this lamb-like beast arises from the earth of Revelation 12 that helped the woman, it says that this beast ends up speaking like a what? Speaking like a dragon. Friedrich Nietzsche once said, "Be careful when you fight the dragon lest you become a dragon."